you've gotten through the April showers and even the May showers. How's your garden doing? Has the wet weather kept you from being outside as much as you'd like? This is Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our gardening show, our experts will talk about what you still have time to plant and answer your questions for the full hour. Joining me now are Civic Garden Center Director of Education, Mary Dudley, Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director, Peter Hunninger, and Krohn Conservatory Horticulture Manager, Kelly Wanstroth. Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
We know you have questions for our experts, so give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Now, Peter, are we in trouble if we haven't planted our vegetable gardens yet?
Well, June, it's, we were talking about, like, you can still get things in. It's too late for peas, but it's an ideal time to plant beans.
Okay.
So you have a lot of options. And if you're buying seedlings, this is still plenty of time to plant your peppers and tomatoes, which are the most popular of all the vegetables probably grown for homeowners and community gardeners.
So what can we plant now in the June is upon us?
Well, June, it's, your brassicas, your cabbage and things like that. You might be a little late on that. You may want to wait and do that in the fall for the fall planting, because when it heats up, they'll want to bolt fairly quickly. But you could still put in lettuces, particularly if you're using shade cloth. And then, like I said, your eggplant, tomatoes, peppers, and then beans, you can still direct sow. Beets is another thing you could still do. It's a little late for carrots. I'd wait for the fall if you're direct sowing carrots.
So this is good news for kids who don't like broccoli.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay. Kelly, how important is weeding the garden this time of year, and when's the best time to weed?
I feel like it's extremely important, not only by looks, but it invites unwanted pests in your yard, takes other natural resources that the plants, desired plants, could be taking. I used to always tease when I was a teacher to tell them that the best time to weed was when they're little, before they start putting those big tap roots, before they set seed. That's important. And then after it rains. So with all the rain we have, it makes it really easy to pull them out of the soil.
Yeah, because the soil is kind of wet and
correct.
Doesn't fight with you quite as much. Mary, what's your guidance for weeding and compost?
Yeah, so when you are adding weeds to your compost, you really want to make sure that they have not gone to seed. In our early spring rains, I've seen some things going to seed a little earlier than we would expect. And so take a look at those weeds. If they're already fluffing seeds out, it's a good idea to get those seeds into a bag and into your trash and not your compost. It's really ideal to be able to weed out things that have kind of in between their flowering and their seeding phases. And so, if you've got a plant that's doing multiple things at the same time, just be very aware of that. If you put those seeds into your compost pile and you don't get the compost pile hot enough to kill those seeds, then you could be adding those seeds to your garden again next year.
Mm. Is this an argument for flamethrowers and compost piles?
Oh, love a good flaming time.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, the thing about the flame, when people flame vegetable beds, it's usually what you do is after you clear a bed, you weed it, hoe it, and then you let it sit, and then the brand new weeds, as they sprout and they're very tiny and young, that's when you flame them quickly. Mm. And you're not really burning them. You're almost heating them up, and it causes them to wilt and die back. And so that's a pretty standard agricultural practice, particularly for market gardeners and people working larger scale.
Okay.
But keep it away. If you have a plastic greenhouse, don't go near it with a weeder. Stay away from your plastic garbage cans. You get some training on it first.
And be careful of mulch.
Exactly.
I know people who have used them near mulch lines and their mulch is caught on fire.
Oh, yeah, that's not good.
And like when weeds are little in my yard, if they're not having any seeds or anything on them, I just leave them where they are. And they compost naturally in place and just help add to the organic material in the garden.
Yeah, the chop and drop thing is really great. And, we were talking about, like, you can pull the weeds out when the soil is damp or moist and is pliable. But sometimes during July and August, you'll get kind of a crust that's hard. But using a stirrup hoe and just lightly scraping the top of the surface, the dry soil actually kind of helps you a little bit chop off the weed. And it also creates a kind of dust mulch.
Hmm.
Yeah, but I always think, like, hoeing is, like, people just don't do enough of it. And if you work with people who move here from other countries, whether it be Bhutan or from Central America, you know, they are very active and use hoes a lot.
Yeah, one of my favorite garden tools. I was wondering how long it was going to take Peter to bring up the stirrup hoe. It's definitely great. Yeah.
Okay. Hot tip, everybody. Get yourself a stirrup hoe if you don't have one already. We have a voicemail from a caller with a question about backyard chickens.
Hi. I have backyard chickens and a vegetable and herb garden. I am wanting to make the most of my backyard chickens. I enjoy their eggs, and they produce plenty of guano, very rich fertilizer. I'm wondering what the best way is to use this fertilizer, and I don't have the patience to compost it. I know you can compost it, but I've read some about soaking it in water and using the water as a liquid fertilizer. I'd like some information. Thank you.
Okay. Well, Peter and Mary, I know you both have chickens. Let's go to you, Peter.
I'm an advocate for composting it. You can make a manure teas and things like that out of it, but that can also kind of go wrong.
Mm-hmm. Did you say manure teas?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like TEA? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, well, basically what he's talking about.
Okay.
You take a five-gallon drink. No.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The plants can drink it.
Gotcha. Okay.
Compost tea.
Okay.
Compost
tea. Thank you. I'm sorry.
That's a good point to clarify.
Yeah, I was a little alarmed for a minute, but please go ahead.
No. So you can do it with, people will do it with other types of animal manures also, but, usually involves, adding molasses or aerating it and stuff like that. I know it's a little slower, but because you with the chicken manure, you're taking it out and you have bedding. It would be like wood shavings or straw or hay, and then you already got a good mix of carbon in there. So I would go ahead and really recommend just staying with composting it, unless you get some specialized training with people that are involved with doing these different compost teas.
Yes. Thank you. Mary, have you ever tried the slurry / compost tea?
I have made compost tea from vermiculture before, but with my chickens, I agree with Peter. It is a game of patience, but I let my chicken manure age for 2 years before I am incorporating that into any parts of my garden. And currently, I'm still kind of in that experimental phase with, okay, how does it look here and what plants are really benefiting from it? So I'm going to have chickens for a long time. And now that I've had that couple years, I'm getting it every season when I want it now. So I think it was worth the wait, and I've had no issues.
2 years? That's like a fine wine situation going on. Is that how long you compost?
She's much more patient than I am. it depends on what you're mixing it in and if you're turning it. There's a couple of different things. I would say the absolute minimum would be 6 months, but I think we're probably looking at 9 months to a year is what we're doing as a general rule.
Okay. Well, we're talking about gardening for the full hour today. It doesn't have to be about chicken slurry. We can talk about other stuff. If you have questions or comments, give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We were before that question, and with the composting and everything, we were talking about weeds. Kelly, I've read a lot about these homemade solutions like vinegar and dishwashing liquid. Do those actually work to kind of keep weeds under control?
They work in the sense that they'll burn off the top. If they're supposed to do it in the full sun of the day, which is a lot different than other weed methods. I don't necessarily like what it's doing to the soil. Mm. I do that in one area of my yard where I have dogs, and it's in the sidewalk cracks or the pavers. I use vinegar to do that, or the flamethrowers. Depends on how much gas I have. But I would not recommend doing it in a garden where the soil chemistry is more important.
And why do you pick that area where you've got dogs?
I don't use like glyphosate or anything in my yard because of the animals and all the insects and everything else.
Yeah. Do they stay away from the vinegar smell? Do your dogs
Yeah. I mean, they don't bother with it at all. Yeah.
So that's good. Mm-hmm. That's good. Okay. Have you ever tried that homemade stuff, Mary?
So, yeah, I discovered that there are different strengths of vinegar.
Yes.
So the vinegar that you get at the grocery store is actually not that strong, albeit the smell when you're cooking with it or, you know, can seem that way. But you can buy industrial strength vinegars online. And so those have worked very well for parking areas, places that have pavements that, you know, these little brick paths that I'm trying to work through. That might not be good for a pressure washer or something like that.
And it just doesn't get to the roots. So, I mean, I have to do it quite a few times, and they're still there. And
yeah.
But it's better than always trying to get those little things up between the cracks.
The horticultural vinegar is 30% acidity. And actually, a lot of the big box garden places are now selling it in some of the smaller hardware stores. And I think the advantage of it maybe is when, like you said, it cracks in the sidewalk or something where you can't get a hoe in. But like you said, it's not systemic, so it does not kill the roots. So you need to immediately follow up with hoeing.
Okay.
So if you have a thick thatch of something, maybe applying it once. But particularly in vegetable beds, you know, I would really recommend not doing it unless it's a last resort.
And you can think about smothering. That's something that, you know, if I've really got a patch that's just, oh my gosh, what's happening? Maybe it's coming out of the corner of my raised bed. You know, I'm going to lift that bed up and put down 2-3 layers of cardboard, you know, mulch over that. That's going to buy me a lot of time.
That's my favorite.
Yeah.
I have completely gotten rid of lawns and transformed them by, it's patience again, but putting down that couple layers of cardboard, putting mulch on top of it, I'd much rather see that than landscape fabric. I hate that stuff. And then like the weeds following up because you're not churning the soil, you're not bringing up all those dormant weeds that are work their way down in it also.
The joys of smothering weeds. Okay, we have a caller on the line. Hey, Patrick. Hey, Patrick, thanks so much for calling. What's your question or comment?
So I have a shady area of grass on a hillside at my house, and above the hillside is a big pine tree. And the grass grows there, but it's pretty patchy. And when I get new grass to grow, which is possible, it will grow for a month or two and then die off and become bare again and patchy. I'm just curious what I need to do to amend the soil or the type of grass to plant or what you guys recommend for that kind of area.
I assume you don't want to chop down that tree.
Please don't take down the tree.
Yeah.
So what kind of grass seed are you using?
Well, I think I've fine fescue maybe because it's shady.
Because I know some of the like tall fescues, which are more sunny, they will go dormant. A lot of people think that their grass is dead in the heat of the summer, July, August, and it's not. It's just dormant.
Okay.
I don't know. I've gotten rid of all the grass in my yard.
Well, a friend of mine, I talked to a landscape person one time, and they brought up something about grass around the tree. The people sometimes think it's because it's not getting sun. But he said the tree, grass is competing with the tree for moisture. So particularly during dry parts, they said just to water a little bit more underneath the trees, and often that'll help maintain the grass. So you could give that a shot.
There's also going to be some competition with those roots. And so just depending on, you know, the slope of your hillside and how near to the surface your roots are, you know, that might be something. So aeration is never a terrible idea. Also, you could think about adding, you know, a layer of compost if you wanted a little bit more nutrients there to help you maintain some soil moisture. But yeah, I would be cautious working around those roots. And it's good that you're trying to get something to establish there to keep that hillside where it is. I would think that a little bit of compost might help.
Okay. Well, I hope that helps, Patrick. Thank you so much for calling. We sure appreciate it. Well, let's keep talking about, we talked about weeds. Peter, what's your favorite method for keeping these weeds in check? Are you a fan of the smothering?
Well, I've used smothering for developing new beds. That absolutely works. And using cardboard, I don't know what it is about the cardboard, but earthworms, it seems to really attract them, so you get some aeration also. But in terms of an established garden, whether it be a flower bed or a vegetable garden, really, really good weeding in the fall is critical.
And early spring. I mean, they're seasonal weeds.
Yeah.
People don't realize that they don't just come up one time a year. They come up.
Yeah, so if you weed well and clean up and mulch during the fall, then when you come in the spring, you know, you'll still have additional weeds to kind of work with, but it gives you a head start. You know, the worst thing to do is just to ignore your garden in the fall and come back in the spring. It's just going to be compound your problems. But also just hoeing and chop, whether it be chop and drop, or whether you rake it up and compost those weeds, but, you know, get them when they're young.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to continue our gardening show after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about gardening for the full hour today. My guests are Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director Peter Huttinger, Krohn Conservatory Horticulture Manager Kelly Wanstroth, and Civic Garden Center Director of Education Mary Dudley. If you have questions, and we know you do, give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. And we have a caller who is waiting to talk with us right now. Hi, Mary. Thanks so much for calling. What's your question?
Hi, thank you. I heard one of the guests say that landscaping fabric is bad, and I wondered why. And then I wanted to ask about using plastic bags as and in between the ground and the mulch. Is that something that I can use?
I don't recommend either. Again, I love the cardboard. I hate using plastic in the garden, first off. But I also
Why
find
is that, Kelly?
It's just plastic.
It's aesthetics or just
environmentally?
Environmentally,
it doesn't break down. Mm-hmm. Plants will break down on top of it, under your mulch, on top of that, and you still get the weeds. If you've ever tried changing a bed that has had landscape fabric in it, it's so hard to get it removed from everything that has grown within it, out of it. I've also find like when I've pulled it up, just like the molds and stuff that can be trapped underneath the plastics. Again, when you can have something like cardboard that will naturally break down, let all the water permeate through. You know, that's another, I wouldn't use plastic for that. Mm-hmm. I know the landscape fabric does have holes in it that water will get through, but so do the weeds. Mm-hmm. And they grow on top of it.
And it does photodegrade over time. So when you've left it out there, even the plastic bags, like I was tempted. I had a couple of extra bags, empty bags of mulch after I was in an area and I had run out of cardboard. I was like, oh, I could just use these plastic bags. But very quickly, you know, if they're exposed to that sunlight, they just turn into dust. And it's very hard to manage that and make sure that you are not creating a larger problem with all of these little microplastics now that you can't get out.
Yeah. There you go. Mary, I hope that helps. Thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, we were talking about composting. We were talking about weeding. Let's talk fertilizing. That feels very connected to composting. Kelly, what are your best tips for fertilizing?
I compost, but a lot of any of my perennials and shrubs, all I do is I do not rake my leaves. I leave my weeds in place. That is, nature takes care of, the worms take care of all my fertilizing. Now, annuals and tropicals and my containers are a whole different story. I do use synthetic fertilizers on that. I start off with like a slow-release urea coated fertilizer. And then I would like Osmocote is a trade name that you can find at Home Depot. And then I also do the liquid feed, again, to get those big, beautiful annuals eat a lot. We want them to do a lot. We want them to bloom from May to frost. So they, some more than others, require more food. I do not think we need to be using a 20-20-20. I think the phosphorus, the second NPK, the P, we're way overdoing. And that's where we're getting a lot of the algae blooms in our water systems. So I think that could definitely be taken down a huge notch.
Hmm. What do you think, Mary? Do you have other thoughts on fertilizing?
I also compost, but I'm also really interested in these living soils. There are some really amazing combinations of soils coming out now that have mycorrhizae in them. And so that is where they introduce a fungal element, a good fungal element.
So we can
kind of have nature do some of this work for us. And so we can strengthen that soil structure and those mycorrhizal associations. So when I see issues in my garden bed, my first thought goes to, oh, I think I need to renew this soil and rejuvenate it with something. But with my chickens, I have a lot of eggs. And so I soak my eggs in water, my eggshells in water after I have used them. I will water plants with that water, that egg water. That was a tip from my friend Gabby. And I don't have any scientific proof to show that it's doing good things, but I think that it is.
So. I throw the eggshells and coffee grounds directly, every eggshell, into the gardens. I have slugs, so that helps with the slugs, too.
Really? What does it do to the slugs?
Just the sharp edges of the eggs.
You're slicing up slugs with your eggshells? You're kind of vicious, Kelly. You're smothering weeds. You're slicing up slugs.
Flamethrower.
I'm glad you're on my side. Yeah, no kidding.
Well, with fertilizer, too, is that, you know, you want things that are more slow release. I know when we're putting in our bedding plants, like tomatoes and peppers, we use a lot of fish emulsion.
Yes.
And so we'll mix that up as directed. It's usually a couple, you know, an ounce per gallon or less, whatever's on the particular concentrate that you get. Always follow the instructions on there. And what we'll actually do is have a bucket, a pail of that liquid, and we actually dip, after we take this bedding, the tomato plant out of the plastic container, we dip it into the solution, loosen up the roots, and then plant it. And then we'll also, you know, then water the drip line around the plant so that to kind of saturate the soil and to kind of help get rid of any air pockets. Mm-hmm. And that's good. But you can over fertilize plants. And so particularly like tomatoes after the end of June and into early July, we really don't, unless there seems to be an issue, we don't really fertilize these fruit-bearing plants because they'll have a tendency to just want to grow leaves. You know, occasionally I'll get a call from a gardener saying that, you know, my plants are, tomatoes are giant, they're big, beautiful leaves, they're bright green or beautiful, deep green. But they're not producing fruit. And I say, you know, they'll say, well, yeah, I fertilize them every week. You know, yeah. The plant has to experience some stress in order to want to reproduce and to procreate, in a sense. So that's something to, you know, to keep in mind, not to over-fertilize.
We've got a couple of emails, one from Ginger. Ginger asks, I'm thinking about planting a wisteria. Any tips on how I could prevent it from becoming too big or general tips for wisteria?
Please
stick with the native.
Yes, please plant American wisteria and do not plant any of the other varieties. They are monsters.
I've even struggled with the American. I have my small space. I came up 3 years after digging and digging and between my house and my porch and gutters. And so just be lots of pruning to keep them in check and stick with the, is it Floribunda? Is that the native one? I do believe, but stick with the native one. Yeah. And they do have smaller cultivars of the native one. Amethyst Showers may be the name of it, but...
Yeah, and have it be in a place that you can easily access. So yes. That's really the trick, I think, with the one that we have at Civic Garden Center. It climbs up to our green roof, and thankfully we have a garden on the green roof. So I can access the tops of these vines as they are kind of wrapping around this railing, and so I can really get ahead of it. But otherwise, you know, if it was in an area that was inaccessible, it would be hard to control.
Yeah. What's the best time to prune if you're going to whack the top off that wisteria to try to keep it under control?
So they are done blooming now, and they are getting their seed pods out. We are cutting ours back. We wanted to make sure we had those spring blooms, and so we waited to cut that back until after flowering season. So you could do that now, but I honestly wouldn't wait. If you need to cut it back and you might lose a couple of blooms in the spring, it's okay. It's pretty hardy.
Yeah. But I'd say a good rule of thumb is cutting things back after the bloom.
Okay, good. We have a question from Larry. Larry asks, I have a cherry tree that is covered in cicadas. Do they hurt the tree? If so, what should I do to help the tree recover? What do you think, Peter?
Yeah, they will hurt the tree, and they'll put these little tiny slits in it. What you can do is kind of shoo them away, and then you can use like insect netting over the tree. Yeah, because it'll be a problem. And what'll happen, you won't see it so much this year, but next year you'll start these seeds, little slits will kind of dry up, and then you'll start losing branches. Now, some people will tell me that the cicadas actually prune trees for the future.
I was going to say, that is, I've...
Yeah.
You don't buy that?
Well,
I do.
Yeah, for large trees, mature trees, yes, that's true. But if you have a fruit, particularly if you have a dwarf or semi-dwarf varieties, you need to control the cicadas on those. But, you know, your maples and different trees and larger, more mature trees, you know, it's part of... the interaction with nature, you know, mm-hmm. the symbiotic relationships. But for small fruit-bearing plants, you want to monitor that.
But you also want to be sure, but like, be careful with your netting. I know I've netted trees before I planted them and put them up and did a lot of damage taking that netting off, right. Trying to get the netting off of them. And then to be sure, like, when the cicadas are done, to take it off, to, you know, don't leave it on. Yeah. Longer than you have to after they get done doing their mating dance and stuff.
And also there's bird netting and there's insect netting, and those are two very different things. And so, you know, be sure you get the insect netting.
Okay. All good tips. We appreciate that. Peter, it's been such a wet spring. How do you drain waterlogged soil? What do you do about that?
Well, I mean, that's, you want to work year round on making, or year after year, for decades, having good soil with a good organic content so that it can dry. You know, naturally our soils here have a lot of lime in them, but they're also a lot of clay. So it can get very tricky. I mean, even in the gardens that we've had, were very well established, we battle with that in this region. So by building your beds up as a mound, if you have rows, or if you're using the wooden box type, or some people are now using different kits that are, you know, the galvanized metal and stuff, by having it raised up, if you have a lot of organic matter in your soil, that should drain. But if you're growing directly in the ground without raised wooden beds, you really want to mound up your soil so that it'll help it drain. And you can also, Mary mentioned the idea of aerating your soil. So using a spading fork or a broad fork to go over your soil and to you push the tines in and you rock them back and forth and pull them straight out. What you want to do is pierce the soil, and that allows other water to go into it and break up the clay pan, but also allows organic matter to go in there and to mature, and then you get the mycorrhizae and so forth. Also, humic acid is a type of, it sounds dangerous, but it's not. It's a kind of compost liquid. But what it does is it feeds the microbiology of the soil. And so applying that periodically to your garden, too, is a good thing, because what you want to do is get the earthworms and all this other, you know, fungi and bacteria, all the beneficial stuff working in your soil to help build that soil and open it up for good drainage.
And I will say that after you do all that work, you really want to make sure that you're not then compacting it. And so in my areas of the garden that are muddy, that's where I walk. Those are my trails. And so, you know, as much as I don't necessarily feel like I need the mulch for aesthetics, because, you know, I don't mind getting a little bit muddy, I understand that that's an important step to be able to protect these compacted areas from really collecting all that water. So we're doing a lot of mulching and just kind of trying to control some of the muddiness there.
I love that compost not only helps with the wet soils, but it also helps with dry soils. Like, I live in the Mill Creek Valley, and my soils are super sandy. So I'm always adding the opposite. My soils are super dry. So compost or organic matter, breaking it down. I like make sure your organic matter is broken down, because it can bind nitrogen if not. But it helps both ways.
Yeah. We have a caller on the line. Hey, William, thanks for calling. What's your question or comment?
My question is, some gardeners recommend putting down cardboard when they're going to have a raised bed area. And I don't understand the logic of putting down the cardboard as a barrier, because you're going to be putting soil into that raised bed. So why worry about putting down cardboard, which could be, you know, have chemicals in it, you know, as far as something printed on the box or the chemistry of the cardboard. So I don't know.
Yeah, I think it depends on where that raised bed is. So if you're trying to plant right on top of an area that is, you know, sod, like lawn, you're going to want to remove that sod layer because that thatch is going to make it a little bit difficult for roots to go through. And so then you have this open seed bed. And so weed seeds can live for decades. They're still doing experiments on how many hundreds of years some of these seeds are viable. So once they're exposed to that sunlight, if you're removing that grass layer, then you can be starting some problems. Even if you're adding a lot of soil, 12 inches of soil, some of these seeds are just like, great, awesome, it's my time to shine. So the cardboard creates a barrier with that. And a lot of times I actually don't remove the sod if I'm using cardboard, because the cardboard will smother that grass and it will start to decompose and act like a green manure. And I understand that there are some adhesives and you want to try to get some of those off. There are places you can buy cardboard that don't have labels and haven't been used for things like that. So you can really do your shopping. But really, that's it. You're kind of waking up that seed bed. And so you're not really sure what is going to come up. So it's kind of a preventative measure.
But you can, if you don't want to use the cardboard, you can tarp the spot where you're going to put the bed and let the tarp smother the grass. And I generally will have a tendency to say, have that smother the grass beyond the border of where your box is going to go. The grass will eventually come back in, but then that'll kind of and then I actually will trench about 2 or 3 inches, maybe 4 inches down around the outside edge to make sure there's no rhizome from the grass going up, and then filling the bed after that.
Okay. And you tarp it with like a regular camping tarp, or are you using plastic?
Well, you could use
sheeting.
You could use plastic sheeting, or you know, you can also. We're preparing beds at Price Hill for planting blueberries later in the fall, and we put down cardboard and put stones and bricks on top of it, and it's killing the grass underneath. And then you can then just then remove the cardboard and put it straight through. But I mean, I'm not opposed to using cardboard.
Would the cardboard also maybe help create a layer if the soil was contaminated below it? So if you're growing plants and you don't, like, I know I live with a lot of lead in the neighborhood that's in the soil. So could that cardboard at the bottom of a growing bed for food help keep the new plants' roots from reaching the soil that may be contaminated?
I don't think so.
Okay. I was just curious.
I mean, it might reduce like splash up, especially if you are if you're sheet mulching with cardboard and then putting mulch on top. I know that Gary does that a lot in Walnut Hills, because that's the splash up of the soil on the food is more of a concern than the uptake within the soil, because a lot of the crops he's growing do not actually uptake that lead.
Yeah. I think, William, you had another question too, right?
Yes, I was wondering about how to deal with neighbors that have invasive species that they planted on their property that comes over onto mine, like Carolina creeper or the trumpet vines that do that underground horizontal rhizoning thing. And so I'm dealing with whack-a-mole in my garden area because of all this stuff that grows up from my neighbors.
Trumpet vine, I do believe, is a native, so it can't be invasive, but it is very aggressive, and I'm sorry that you live next to it. I'm glad I don't.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a hassle. Definitely is a hassle.
And then I'm not from a Carolina creeper. Is that like Creeping Jenny?
Virginia creeper? Is it the five leaves?
Yeah. So
also
another native?
Native, but can't be invasive. Also aggressive. So the you know, these vines, really, if you're seeing them kind of come up through your garden, hopefully, I mean, maybe you can have a friendly conversation with your neighbor. but otherwise, it's just kind of gardener job security. And what I was pulling a lot of Virginia creeper off of a structure earlier in the week. It doesn't do damage in the way that some of these other invasive species will. And so if it's not, you know, invading in your home space and it's on another plant or like a tree, sometimes it can be a good ecosystem
on a
helper.
Tree.
The Virginia creeper doesn't like make the incisions like the.
Wouldn't you be afraid to climb it and smother it? I've seen it take over a tree.
I mean, I think you have to balance that, right? So depending on what your aesthetic looks like. But we do also have trumpet vine at the back end of our property, right up to Mount Airy Forest. And that one's a lot harder, I've noticed, to deal with.
Yeah, there's big seed pods go everywhere.
Yeah, and sometimes they don't, you know, all the way on the ground. I can't find where that starting point is. And so I'm like, so that one I've struggled with quite a bit more. Would you have recommendations on how on using any kind of sprays for that, Peter?
I mean, it's systemic synthetic sprays, which I don't recommend using. I mean, it basically, we deal by grubbing it out and controlling it or mowing it, and that's it. I mean, but as homeowners, it is bring up an interesting point. If you're doing your yard as natives or you have a more conventional lawn or planting things that are invasive, you know, just try to be respectful of your neighbors. You know, keep 2 or 3 feet out from your fence line or your property line if you have things that might travel. Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, I've seen a number of situations where it get pretty frustrating.
And it's wonderful to hear that they're planting all these native plants. But, yes, I think people are finding that some of these natives can be very aggressive, and you've got to be out there taking care of it just like you would any other part of your garden. Yeah.
Well, thanks for calling, William. Thanks for those questions. We appreciate it. We are going to be back after a short break to wrap up today's gardening show. If you have questions, now is the time to call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our gardening show. My guests are Crone Conservatory Horticulture Manager Kelly Wanstroth, Civic Garden Center Director of Education Mary Dudley, and Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director Peter Huttinger. They're ready to answer your questions, so give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. And we have a caller on the line. Hey, Melissa, thanks for calling. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thank you. First, just a tiny bit of context. I moved here from the West Coast, from California, where people, use plants that are drought resistant or, you know, very native. I'm a little flummoxed here. It's raining off a lot. It's really hot and humid. What plants, and forgive me if you already covered this, but what plants, foreign plants, perennials, annuals, that people recommend for this particular area?
Okay. Thanks, Melissa. I'm going to put you on hold because your audio is a little bit shaky. Do you have thoughts on that, Kelly? Kind of plants that can do well in our weather patterns?
Okay. Sun or shade? There's so many other questions that need to be answered. What kind of soil do you have?
Okay.
I definitely have moisture, dry. I have lots of favorites.
Okay, let's see if I can get her back. Hey, Melissa. Yeah, see, this new software doesn't like me. I know that's kind of a little bit how the sausage is made, but oh, she might have dropped. She hung up, so I can't answer any of your questions. Maybe do you have thoughts about sun or shade?
So I have a lot of shade plants in my dry shade, and I've always started with shrubs, bigger shrubs, like bottlebush buckeye. I like calycanthus, Carolina sweet shrub.
These flowering? I think she's asking about flowering.
These are beautifully flowering bigger shrubs.
Okay.
In front of that, I've worked with, I like heucheras and tiarellas. Tiarella, once they get established, again, this is pretty dry shade. When it comes to a little bit of moisture shade, one of my favorite all times is Spigelia, the Indian pinks. It will take sun, but it will take moisture. It's got this bright red flower with the yellow tips that lasts for months. I like the really early blooming perennials, and I like the later blooming perennials. I hate the mosquitoes, so I like pink turtlehead quite a bit. I love Triceratus, spotted toad lilies.
Lots of great tips here. So
those are some of the easy performing, and that have hellebores. They're not native, but easy performing, dry, not a lot of maintenance.
Okay. Well, I hope that helps. You can tell that Kelly works at the Crone Conservatory. She was just whipping out those flowering plant recommendations. Did you have anything you wanted to add, Mary?
Yeah, I think it's a really great opportunity to put in some edible landscaping. And so you're correct that we have different weather patterns, but we also do experience periods of drought. And so we've been wet now, but that was not the case last season for growing season. And so making sure that you have plants that can kind of do double duty, that you've got your rainwater harvesting system set up or your irrigation system set up. But we have a great early spring season, like Peter mentioned, three seasons of gardening. And so if you can get those kales and those collards and your cabbages and peas in, you're really going to have a nice harvest. We're harvesting a lot from the garden right now. Made a fresh kale salad yesterday morning, and the lettuce is just going gangbusters. So take advantage of that spring opportunity, and also we can plant a lot of those same things in the fall.
Peter, we were talking about tomatoes before. Should tomato cages already be up at this point?
Yeah, as soon as we plant the tomatoes, we either set up trellising or put the cage on them. We don't use cages. We use the cages more for peppers, actually. We use trellising systems for the tomatoes for the most part. But although for home gardeners, particularly if you're growing determinate plants like a Roma paste tomato or something like that, the cages work pretty good.
Well, let's talk more about trellising because I know Mary has lots of questions.
Yes,
so take it away, Mary.
Yeah, so I am really interested in growing pickles, which means I'm growing cucumbers. And I felt like my trellises last year were not tall enough. So what kind of happened was the cucumbers went really gangbusters. And then, they just kind of suffocated themselves out a little bit. I didn't have enough space for them. So I was going to see if that got brought up today and like how big are we planting our trellises?
Yeah. Well, you know, with trellising, I mean, one of the things we use is cattle panels, which is kind of fencing. So they're, you know, only around 5 feet tall. But when we put them onto the T-post, we leave a space on the bottom, so a little bit taller. But the thing I found with, particularly with cucumbers and also with pole beans, is and half runner beans is that, you know, spacing between the plants is critical, you know, because if you read the seed packet, you know, but they have them putting them every 6 inches, well, you really want the plants to be at least a foot apart because then, you know, they can grow up and then also kind of fan out. And that's the trick that I've kind of found is to be cold-hearted and really thin early on. And it's painful and hard to do.
Yeah,
that's great advice. I do hate thinning. So
That's where I've gotten into trouble time and time again, particularly with beans.
Okay.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, get that spacing down and you know.
Yeah. We've got a couple email questions. One from John. He asks, is treated lumber safe for raised garden beds? He says he put in a raised bed with cedar, but it's not going to last more than a few years. I'm going to throw this one to you, Peter, and if you have a quickish answer, because we have another question to ask. Okay.
Well, what I found with the, you know, it depends on, you know, like organic certification, you can't use treated lumber. So the answer is no. But if you go to the EPA, they say it's fine. Where you'll find warnings on using treated lumber actually is more for the people building things with it. Because it is treated with copper now. There's no longer any arsenic. If you have young children, if they're touching that wood on the top, you may want to put a piece of cedar on top of the top edge of it. I have some more detailed information about all this. If you contact WVXU, they'll forward me your contact information, and I'll send out a paper that we did for our gardening classes that go into this in detail.
Okay.
So, but cedar, if you use the regional red cedar, I found that it lasts a lot longer than, I don't know whether the other stuff is coming from the Northwest or Canada, but the regional red cedar, it really outperforms the other cedar.
We have a question from Deborah. Deborah asks, I have mostly sunny, half-acre yard. I've lived here almost 3 years and hope to have more native plants, more meadow-like yard, but have drainage issues with a lot of lesser celandine, under mature maple trees, and also creeping charlie in a lot of my yard. Any suggestions for plants to compete? Also have not used herbicides, but wondering if this is the only way to remove these plants. You're our weed killer, Kelly.
Thoughts? I am glyphosate.
Wow.
Yes, I would, especially with the lesser celandine. I think it's impossible to get all of those roots. I see it in my neighborhood coming closer and closer to my house, and I'm just like, I want to walk around and just kill it all. And it's just such a quick life, too, that if you don't get it when it comes up, it's gone, and it doubles and comes up more. Creeping Charlie, I've warned people about planting it, and I see that coming towards my house, too. But that's in a maintained yard. Yeah, that's. I would try to get that maintained before starting anything new.
Yeah,
and figuring out your drainage issues, and whether or not that's like, you know, kind of funneling that overland flow into a rain garden, or maybe more of an area that could be a little bit moist feet with some plants that don't mind that. But making sure that those trees are staying healthy so that you can enjoy them for many years. Though you want all of that infrastructure to be in place, especially as you start to think about applying any kind of chemicals. Where are those going to go when it starts to rain and drain, so that you're not ruining what you've already planted?
Yeah. Well, I've got a question for, I don't know who's going to answer this, but I was preparing for this program and I was reading all about how we should dump standing water to keep mosquitoes at bay. Totally on board with that. But then I was also reading about the importance of bird baths and having water in bird baths. So what's the deal? Like, what should we be doing? Bird baths are standing water, right? Yeah.
Every morning spray them out.
Yeah.
It's just got to be clean water. Mm. So mosquitoes don't like the clean water?
Any standing water. So if you're cleaning it out every day, it doesn't give them as much chance to keep those larvae going. My neighbor, and I have no idea how it worked, bought last year a little
whirly
thing that you put in. It just keeps the water movement going.
Stirring it around.
That will help keep the larva from...
Larva
germinating. Yeah.
I mean, I've broken up those mosquito dunks.
That was going to be the next thing I say, is like the little dunks. You could add those to... I just spray mine out every day. But with the bird flu, I'm even nervous about having water sitting with all the different birds. Yeah. So.
Well, we keep bird baths for a couple reasons. Is that one is for bees. We
That's
put some stones in there. So they need water. But we do, I don't clean them out every day, but we just spray them, empty them and just refill them, you know, once or twice a week. And that seems to be fine. But, you know, it is important also, you know, if you have trouble with birds going after your tomatoes and lettuce or squirrels, they'll also drink the water.
Okay.
And well, they'll help you out.
I've been talking with Civic Garden Center Director of Education, Mary Dudley, Turner Farm Community Garden Program Director, Peter Huttinger, and Crone Conservatory Horticulture Manager, Kelly Wanstroth. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Special helper today is her son, Dorian. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. And technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.